I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The critically acclaimed author, essayist, and activist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie joins me ahead of her appearance at the Baltimore City Lit Festival next week. We'll talk about her work, her unique imprint on cultural discourse, and her latest collection of essays, Dear Ijeawele, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. She's the author of several books, including Half of a Yellow Sun and Americana, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction in 2013. Her novel, Purple Hibiscus, will be the Maryland One book this fall. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie on why we should all be feminists. Stick around. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And good afternoon. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall on this very beautiful spring day. Hope it is as beautiful as it is here at WYPR, as it is where you are. Thanks for joining us today. My guest is going to be the Nigerian author, essayist, and activist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She splits her time between Nigeria and the United States, where she has a home in Columbia, Maryland. She has won several prestigious awards, including the Orange Broadband Prize for Fiction and a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, often referred to as a genius grant. She will be headlining the 2017 Baltimore City Lit Festival later this month. That takes place on Saturday, the 29th of April. It's an annual affair. It's going to take place at the University of Baltimore. It's a terrific event. It has lots of authors and panels of folks in the book business. It's great for writers. It's great for readers. It's great for folks who love literature and who love reading. There will be a number of authors speaking at that event, and Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie will be one of them. I'm very glad to be asked to moderate a conversation with Ms. Adichie at that event. The event, by the way, with Ms. Adichie is sold out, but they have started a list of people who get on a waiting list to be in an alternate room and have a video feed, a live video feed. So if you go to our website, wypr.org/midday, you can get information about how to find a ticket to that event. So again, it's an annual event. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, just one of several terrific authors who will be appearing, and we hope you can join us on Saturday the 29th. That's a week from Saturday. Ms. Adichie writes with tremendous power and grace. Her prose is unshakably grounded on a fundament of authority, compassion, and an unquenchable sense of wonder. She has recently become one of my favorite authors, and I'm sad to say that I'm new to her work. I read Americana just a few months ago and have read a few collections of her essays since. It's just terrific stuff. So if you haven't checked it out, you should definitely do so. She's the author of three novels, Purple Hibiscus, Half a Yellow Sun, and Americana. She published a short story collection in 2009 called The Thing Around Your Neck, and a TED Talk that she gave in December of 2012 was published as a book called Why Should We Should All Be Feminists. Her latest book was published last month. It takes up similar issues. It's called Dear Ijeawele, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. And Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, I am delighted to meet you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
It's great to have you here.
It's nice to be here.
I was so taken with this novel, Americana, and I can't wait to read the other ones. And I wonder, because you also have written essays, including We Should All Be Feminists, that has really just taken off. I mean, people around the world are using this as a sort of the germ of the argument that they're making about feminism. You really have sort of become, whether you wanted to or not, the spokesperson for the feminist movement in large measure. But I wonder, when you set out to write an essay, you have an idea, you have some points you want to make, you decide the arc of the essay, and you do it within the confines of that. You write this book, Americana, which is sweeping. It's this grand novel. It's got tons of characters. It takes place in Baltimore and New Jersey and New York and London and Lagos and New Haven and all over the place. people from different generations. Do you, and you make many of the same points in Americana that you're making in the essays that you're writing about feminism and other subjects. Do you set out at the beginning of the novel writing process to do that in the way, the same kind of way that you set out to do it in the essay writing process?
No, no. But I think that's a very good question, because even for the creative process, it's a relevant question. But for me, I occupy two very different creative spaces when I do both. So when I write essays, I'm much more deliberate. I know what I'm... Well, I like to think I know what I'm doing.
Don't we all? <Yeah. laughs>
And I know what I want to say. Of course, the question is whether or not I have, in fact, said it the best way possible, but I know what I'm doing in general. With fiction, it's a lot more intuitive. I like to say it's much more magical for me. Characters take on a life of their own. Sometimes I want a character to do something, the character doesn't. And of course, when I tell the story to people who don't write fiction, they look at me as though I'm crazy. And so in some ways, I think that my nonfiction is about my worldview, and my fiction is about that much more magical, difficult to pin down thing about the world, because the world is messy. And I think the thing that's interesting about being a creative person, and that's what I like to think of myself primarily as, is that the world doesn't always align with your ideology. And so in my essays, it's really about how I want the world to be. But my fiction, I think, is about how the world is.
I have a daughter who's a playwright. And she's talked about how she is surprised often at the end of the process of writing a play. I wonder, were you surprised at the end of your novels about what happened? I mean, you start with a general idea, but then what kinds of things surprise you about, say, Americana or Purple Hibiscus?
In Americana, for example, I remember the ending. I remember wanting to impose myself on the ending, and the characters resisted.
So you wrote different endings?
No, it's that I had what I imagined would happen in my head, but that's not what happened when I was writing it. When I started to write it, something else happened. So it's like the spirit's calling you, and you have no choice but to answer.
So the muse is a real thing?
I think so. On the other hand, I don't want to make it too mystical and over-romanticize it, because it's also about hard work. It's also the craft of it.
You got to sit down and write.
You have to. And there are times when I have wanted to write and I'm sitting in front of my laptop and nothing is happening. And then there are other times when I have other things to do and a story just won't leave me alone.
Explain the term Americana for folks.
Americana is a word used in Nigeria for it, and it's a playful word. It's a word used for people who have become Americanized. So people who've been to the U.S. and come back. But also often it's used for people who affect Americanization. So people who, having spent some time in the U.S., go back to Nigeria and suddenly pretend that they no longer understand Igbo or Yoruba or any other Nigerian languages, and put on a very affected American accent. And so they then become Americana.
I have a friend who has spent much of his career in France. He's an American. He's from Brooklyn. And he does the same thing all the time. When I visit him in Paris, he'll say, oh, what's the word in English? I mean, you know, he spoke English for 25 years before he lived in Paris. So I know that. And what's fun about the characters in this book, I mean, you talk about the dynamics of the workplace, the dynamics of the family institution, the dynamics of different neighborhoods in different cities. And you capture it all so beautifully. I want you to tell us a little bit about Ifemelu and Obinze, who are the two protagonists in Americana, only because I really want people to read this book. And so I want you to whet their appetite a little bit.
So Ifemelu, I like to think of Americana as, among other things, an old-fashioned love story. So they meet when they're teenagers in Nigeria, and then they leave Nigeria for different reasons. Ifemelu comes to the U.S., Obinze goes to England, and it's so hard for me to. And they go through many, many things. and the relationship unravels, and years pass, and things have changed in their lives, and they have grown, I think, in more ways than they would have had they not left Nigeria. And then Obinze moves back to Nigeria, or rather Obinze is deported from the UK. Ifeoma later moves back, and...
stuff happens.
Yes.
Chaos ensues. Right. I'm not a literary critic. I have no credentials in this notion. But I have to say, I mean, it reminded me a lot of 100 Years of Solitude because of the breadth of it. I mean, it wasn't 100 years, but it was a long time in the lives of the people. And War and Peace, to tell you the truth. There's so many different characters, so many people in there, and their grandparents and fathers and mothers, and they're sagacious and they're nasty and they're charming and they're villainous. And they're just, I mean, it's just, you cook up all these different people, including Ifemelu's job, which is to write a blog about race. And that's a very convenient thing for a person. It's an ingenious solution to a novelist and a fiction writer who wants to make some statements, and very important statements, about race. So what can you say through Ifemelu's voice? Is there stuff you can say through Ifemelu's voice that you can't say through your own?
I suppose I have said quite a few things in my own voice. But you're right that the blog is, it's a tool. And it was a convenient tool for me because I wanted Ifemelu, the character, to say all of these things, many of which I agree with. But to find a way to do that and make it not seem, because I think in the form of a novel, it can seem like hectoring. But then to do it in a blog, and I wanted the blog to be funny. I hoped it would be funny. I mean, I wanted Ifemelu to say important things, but also to hopefully make people laugh. Because the thing about race in this country, which I think race is America's original sin, I also think that there's so much about it that is absurd that it becomes quite darkly funny. And I think I've said, I don't know, I mean, I think I agree with maybe 90% of what Ifemelu says. And I think I'm generally the person who says what I think.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Your reputation precedes you on that score.
I do think that, I do think, though, that one of the things I learned when I came to this country, and I'm a person who grew up in Nigeria, a country of you know, I grew up during military dictatorships. But only when I came to the US did I start to internalize that idea of what you cannot say. There's a kind of, it's that you learn in a subtle way, kind of self-censorship in this country. Never mind that you're immersed in the discourse of free speech. But there's a lot of, you know, you can't say that. And I learned that quite well, I think. But I find ways to push back.
Yeah, that's fascinating. In the context of free speech and our obsession with free speech, there are all sorts of things you can't say.
It's incredible.
There's company you can't keep.
Yes.
There is, yeah, right. Yeah. You write about race so beautifully in this book. And what's really great for a reader like me, a sort of standard issue white guy, is to discern the peculiarities, the complexities of folks you call NABs, non-American blacks, versus Americans of African descent here, African Americans. And the tension that's often between those two communities, to say nothing of the tension that's between, you know, the communities of color in general and white communities. Has that, with the increased scrutiny, because people now have telephones that they can or cell phones that they can record incidents of police misconduct and brutality, that has been brought to the fore in a way in these last few years that it never was heretofore.
Yeah.
Have you seen the dynamic of race change, including between these two communities of non-American blacks and American blacks, as well as in the larger culture? Have you seen it evolve and change? We have this putative conversation about race. Has the conversation changed much, given what's happened in, you know, since the Black Lives Matter movement, essentially?
That's a good question. And I want to say yes and no. Because I think, I mean, what I've been struck by is how even with the videos that we've been seeing, and I just find them just horrendous, I'm still struck by how there's still a lot of commentary about, well, you know, a lot of commentary that seems to in some ways justify that kind of unnecessary violence, really the unnecessary violence of the state. There's still people who will say, well, why didn't so-and-so just, I don't know, raise his hands, come out of the, you know, just these things.
Sometimes
that
they do.
Right.
They get shot anyway.
Even when they do, somebody says, well, why didn't they raise their feet? I mean, it just becomes absurd. And it's very troubling to me because just looking at it, and I, in some ways, I still consider myself an outsider in this country. And so I sometimes think, surely there must be fundamental human things that everybody can agree on. But I think that the history of this country is one in which, because black people have been so dehumanized, sometimes it's difficult. People have inherited that thinking. And so it's almost automatic to try and find ways to justify the violence done against them. For black immigrants in this country, I think it has changed in a way because, of course, when the policeman stops you, he's not asking you whether you're Ghanaian or whether you're originally from Baltimore. He's seeing a black man, and all of the assumptions that come with that apply. I think part of the problem really has been that the most recent movement of black people to this country, so people like me who came in the 1990s, people who came in the late 1980s, it was a different migration. My father was in the U.S. in the 1960s, and it was a period where there was a lot more that African-Americans and Africans walked together in the anti-colonial movement, in the civil rights movement. More recently, I think that my generation of immigrants don't really know African-American history, so that's really part of the tension. And you come here and you absorb all the negative stereotypes, and so sometimes you find black immigrants saying things that remind you of, you know, the movies about 1930s Alabama, right? But I think that the Black Lives Matter is just such an impressive thing that has forced conversations. And I don't like that word conversation when it comes to race. I just feel like, oh, we've had too many bloody conversations. Maybe it's time to
quit talking. Yeah. Let's do something. Yeah. Well, we have to quit talking for just a second while we take a short break. We will have more with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie when we come back. We will take your calls, questions, and comments. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us this afternoon. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, recent attention to cases of missing girls in Washington has sparked a national conversation about missing and exploited children and teens. Human trafficking expert Kimberly Melman Orozco and Natalie Wilson of the Black and Missing Foundation will join me to talk about the factors that drive missing persons cases and the dangers that many runaways face. That conversation is coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is the MacArthur Award-winning author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She's the author of critically acclaimed novels, short stories, and essays. Her latest book is entitled Dear Ijewele, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. She's going to be featured at the City Lit Festival a week from Saturday. And if you'd like to join our conversation today, our phone number, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's talk a little bit about the new book. There's the daughter of one of your friends, Ijewele, and you've written her a letter, which is A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. Tell us a little bit about this young lady you're writing to.
So I grew up with this really lovely woman who we grew up together. She lives in Nigeria. She had a baby 2 years ago, and she wrote to me and said, I want to raise her feminist, so how do I do that? And I remember thinking, how the hell am I supposed to know? But no. But because I had given the speech that became sort of widely known, We Should All Be Feminists.
It was a TED Talk, and then that turned into a book that
yes.
you released, huh?
Yes. And so I think in the minds of many people, I became their person to go to on the subject of feminism, which in itself continues to trouble me because I don't consider myself an expert. So what I did was to write her an email. I decided that I wanted to be honest and practical and sort of straightforward. And but also for me, it was a way to map out my own feminist thinking. I had never, in fact, sat down to write about the things I would do if I were to raise a child. At the time, I did not have a child. I now have a child. My daughter is almost 18 months. And I went back to revise this book after I had my child and when I decided to turn it into a book, because really it was a personal email to a friend. And it made me think about, A, how easy it is to dispense advice when you don't have to, in fact, use it yourself.
Yeah, living other people's lives is so much easier than living our own.
I love telling people what to do. It's harder to tell myself what to do.
Well, that's good. It's a good thing for a fiction writer. You just tell anybody you want to do what you want them to do.
Oh, plain God. It's just fun. But really, it made me also think that I want to try, that this is also a book that I want to follow for myself.
Would you raise a son any different than you would suggest raising Ijewele or your own daughter?
Slightly differently. There are things in the book, so there are 15 suggestions, and I actually use the word manifesto playfully because, you know, it's such a big word that it's very off-putting, and I thought, let's throw it in there and see what happens. I would raise a boy slightly differently. There are things I would do in the same way, which is just fundamentally that I would not think too much about gender, that I would see the child as an individual. But I think I would raise a boy, if I did have a boy, to accept vulnerability as a beautiful thing, not to be ashamed of fear. I think we raise boys in a way that's quite unfair, where we cage them up. And, you know, the little boy falls down, he's crying, and somebody's saying to him, oh, don't cry, get up, be a man. And the girl falls down and cries, and we comfort her. And sometimes I wonder, well, do we wonder then that many men have issues with, you know, emotion? And it's because they've been raised in a way that I think is really inhumane. And so for me, raising a boy would be about making many of these things that I think are really universal human traits, things that boys aspire to. So that whole idea of the macho man who, no, I just wouldn't. I would not tolerate that in my house.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is my guest this afternoon. It's midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, we're at Midday Tom Hall. Here's a email from Sohelia, who says, I'm a big fan and as a mixed-race immigrant can relate to your observations about America from the inside-outside perspective, the messiness of diaspora and cultural mixing and multi-locality. In Americana, you partly explore what it means to be Black and Americanized. I wonder if you could talk about your observations a bit. How are you experiencing this mixing? Because you are now always regularly splitting your time between Nigeria and here in the U.S., right?
I guess the thing to say is that once I get off the plane in Lagos, I don't really think about race, because I don't really need to think about race. Nigeria is obviously majority Black, and race just doesn't. When I'm in the U.S., I've become, having learned the language and the nuances of race, I'm very alert to race. I know when I walk into a restaurant and I'm the only Black person, I immediately know that. In Nigeria, I get off the plane, I forget race, and there's so many other things to think about, by the way. So, because Nigeria is a place where I'm happiest, but it's also the place where I'm most frustrated. And I think that living in both places gives me a kind of, one thing is it kind of makes me an outsider in both places. Not that I much mind, because I think that to be creative, being an outsider is a good thing, because it helps you see, in a way. But I think the other thing is that it... I feel very fortunate that I can have both, because I love both places, but I also wouldn't be happy living the entire year in either place. So I feel very fortunate that I can be in both. I'm two different people, I think. Or rather, actually, here's my little theory about human beings, is that we are, in fact, a multiplicity of selves, and those selves emerge depending on where we are. And when I'm in Nigeria, a friend of mine who's Kenyan came to visit me in Lagos once, and he had only seen me in the U.S. And so in Lagos, he said to me, "You're so different." And I said, "Why?" He said, "You're so loud." And
oh, that's fascinating. Just because everybody in Lagos is loud? It's a loud, bustling, crazy city?
I hadn't thought of myself as, I mean, loud in that sense. But when he said it, I thought, I'm sure I am. Because Nigeria brings it out in you. If you want to be heard, you better bloody be loud.
Well, that is a nice little theory about the human condition. That's terrific. I mean, the comments or the observations you bring to the immigrant experience in Americana are very powerful, and of course very timely now, where we have a discussion about immigration. You know, from a president of the United States whose rhetoric about it was deplorable, just absolutely unforgivably hideous, but this notion of being an expat anywhere, you know, just being locality, as our emailer suggests, I mean, is very important to one's identity. And where do you think the immigration debate here in this country is headed, given who's been elected president?
I really don't know.
Let me ask you then a better question. Where should it be headed? What is the proper immigration policy? As long as we have the laws that are on the books that we have, anything that that ICE is doing, anything that anybody else is doing, is legally permissible. It may not be morally justifiable, but it's legally permissible. What should the immigration policy of the United States of America be?
Oh, how much time do we have? No, I'm kidding.
All day. Take a sip.
Do you know, I think I'd probably want to start by saying that I respect the right that any country has about protecting its borders. I do not think that idea of just all borders being completely open is even practical, because we all agree that the nation state is the construction that we live in. That said, I think that for me, really, it's two things. It's that there are people in this country who've been here for many years, whose lives are here, whose loves are here, who I think it just doesn't even make sense to talk about deporting. And I don't even mean it in terms of how it's unfair and inhumane. It just doesn't even make practical sense. Why would you decide to alienate, humiliate, remove people who love this country, who have people in this country who they love, who contribute to this country? It really doesn't make sense to me. I think the policy should focus on the people who are here. And I really do believe that they should have a path, a very clear and, quite frankly, an easy path to citizenship. I think that whole idea of, you know, get into line and do it the right way. If you know what the getting into line and doing it the right way requires, it's no surprise that people don't.
Yeah, it is tough.
It is. And so that, too, I think, is something that needs to be sort of reconsidered, redone. And for high and low. So Canada, for example, sort of has this thing where they focus a lot on skills, and usually it's people who have 2 degrees. And while that is good, of course, I think every economy needs both. We need the people with the 2 degrees. We need the people who don't have the degrees, the people who will do the, you know, strawberries need to be picked, and they're people. So I think that it has to be a policy that, while focusing on doing things legally, that legal route has to be a doable and a humane route, I think.
Let's go to the phones. Melanie in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Hi. I had to call in. Americana is my favorite novel in recent memory. Last December, I bought a copy for every person on my staff at work because it was such an amazing book. Asemelu is my favorite character in all of literature, and I read the book last summer, which was a very interesting summer to be an African-American woman with all that was going on with this past election. And while reading the book, I kept finding myself in conversations with my friends saying, oh, I have this friend who says, and I'd realize, no, wait, that wasn't a friend of mine. That was something Asemelu said in her blog. And I, in talking to other women, especially other black women, about those blog pieces, which I thought were a fantastic literary device, other women who I know brought up Awesomely Lovey, and we were wondering, many of us, if Efemelu's blog was maybe modeled after Awesome Lee Lovey, as Lovey is an African woman who is commenting on the African American experience as someone who's not an American born black person.
So you're familiar with this character, Awesome Lee Lovey?
I know. Oh, yes, I've recently come to know of her blog and some of her writing. She's actually just really incredible, very insightful, very sharp. But no, because when I was writing American, I didn't know about this blog. I don't know how long the blog's been on, but it wasn't so much based on any particular blog as it was it was something I invented to give Efemelu an opportunity to say what I wanted her to say. I had actually started off in earlier drafts having her write a newspaper column. But it didn't work very well because there's something dated about, I wanted it to be immediate. There's an immediacy that blogs have. And the voice I wanted to use, a sort of slightly throwaway-ish, slightly, serious but not that serious, I felt wouldn't work for a newspaper column. So I thought the blog would work.
It's an excellent draw. And also, she could pop off a blog anytime you wanted her to.
Yes, yes.
She didn't have to wait till Tuesday when her deadline was.
Exactly. And there wouldn't be sort of an editorial presence hovering over her. So that I felt that blogs give it more of an authenticity.
What's also wonderful about this writing to me is that the intersection between feminism, race, immigration, the immigrant experience, gender, all of these things are so beautifully interpolated. You wrote about Michelle Obama in the New York Times last October. It was part of a series of essays about the First Lady as the Obama administration was coming to a close. And you begin that essay saying she had rhythm, a flow and swerve, hands slicing air, body weight moving from foot to foot, a beautiful rhythm. In anything else but a black American body, it would have been contrived. I think that's brilliant because it brings in so many dimensions. And Michelle Obama, represents for so many the epitome of grace and sophistication and guts and intelligence. But that one lead sentence just epitomizes so much of how so many people feel about her. When it comes to feminism, you got in a bit of trouble recently when folks called you out for comments you made about the transgender community and transgender women. Let me ask you to explain what you said and perhaps characterize some of the blowback you got after you said it.
What I had said was that I think that that there is a difference in the way that trans women and women born female experience gender, I was kind of taken aback by I didn't really follow. The reason I knew there was a lot of blowback is that I got many, many emails from friends who were sympathizing with me, and I sort of felt like I had been bereaved or something. But also from kind people, many of whom were trans women, who were saying, we get what you're saying. I think that there is, so on the one hand, I think because that difference is the source of so much violence and oppression, because trans women in particular experience terrible violence, I think there's a wish on certain...
Eight trans women killed in just this area alone in the last few months.
Yep. Actually, I was just watching the news 2 weeks ago, and there's a black trans woman who was just shot. And I think that because of that, there's this wish to sort of pretend that the difference isn't there, because if we do that, then we can wish away the violence. But I think if we don't acknowledge the differences, then we're not able to address the particular things that affect particular groups of people. I also think that some people thought I meant that therefore they're somehow not part of feminism, which I didn't mean, and which I don't think, right? But I do think, and I also had said that the experience of gender is different because trans women have lived in the world as men and so have the kind of privileges that men have, or at least are familiar with those privileges. I think some people also saw that to mean that I was suggesting that their lives are easy. But of course their lives are not easy. It's simply that privilege is always relative, right? In other words, when you're growing up a girl, when you're 10 and your period starts, or even before your period starts, you've already been socialized to think of your body as a shameful thing. Right? I have so many girls who talk about what their parent, what their mothers told them about the sanitary pads. Like, what are you doing with the pad? Make sure you, you know, don't let your brother see the pad. And you start to feel that you're, something's shameful about what's happening to your body. So it's things like that. To experience that in many ways is not to have male privilege. To not experience that is a certain kind of male privilege. So it's things like that that I meant. And of course, also acknowledging that to be trans is very difficult because what's going on is that you've been born in a body that is not yours, but the world is seeing that body and that the world is treating you based on that body that they see. So that's really what the point was. And I think that there were people who didn't want to hear what I wanted to say and just wanted me to use exactly the kind of language that they wanted. And I resisted that because I think there's becoming a kind of language orthodoxy where if you don't say something in the particular way with the particular words, you're ostracized, you're censored. And I think it's I don't think it's good for just continuing to learn and sort of cross-learn, right? And also to think that these are people who are members of my tribe, right? We are all on the same side. And so that was the thing that for me was a bit... That I was taken aback by.
It's a complicated thing. We're going to post, by the way, your original comments as well as your clarifying comments that you put on your Facebook page. We'll have a link to that page so people can look at that and see some of the comments you got on your Facebook page from some of your readers. I did want to bring it up, make sure we mention it at least this afternoon. We are going to take a little bit of a break now. The novelist and essayist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is my guest. Her latest book is called Dear Ijeawela, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. She's also the author of We Should All Be Feminists, based on a very popular TED Talk she delivered in 2012. Her novels include Americana and Purple Hibiscus, which will be the One Maryland One book selection this fall. Congratulations on
Thank
that.
You.
That's terrific. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie will be the headline author at this year's City Lit Festival a week from Saturday. I'm honored that she and I will have a public conversation at 12:30 at the City Lit Festival. That event is sold out, as I mentioned, but there will be an overflow room with a live video feed. Come to WIPR.org/midday for a link to information about that and all of the events at this year's City Lit Festival. When we come back, more with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We will be right back. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the novelist and activist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her latest book is called Dear Ijeawela, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. She's the headline author at this year's City Lit Festival on Saturday, April 29th. And by the way, for a complete list of all the events that are part of the City Lit Festival, come to our website, wipr.org/midday. If you want to join our conversation with Ms. Adichie, you are welcome to. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. One of the other things that I, one of the many things I liked about Americana and like about your writing on feminism is your embrace of those things that are traditionally feminine. Mm. You are the pitch person for a makeup company in the UK. You're doing TV commercials. You're incredibly stylish. You have an Instagram account, which I guess is curated by your nieces, is
yes.
that right? And it's pictures of you in these terrific outfits. I mean, you're this fashionista, you know? You're,
all of which are made in Nigeria, I need to point out.
There you go. Now, so what does that mean? That you won't take Instagram photos of yourself with beautiful outfits on in America? What's that about?
No, it's really that I was going to do a number of events for the new book, and I thought because the Nigerian currency has recently tumbled, and now there's sort of this thing in Nigeria where people say buy Nigerian to grow the economy. And the president actually recently said that 2 days a week have to be wear only Nigerian made clothes in Nigeria. So I thought that would be a really cool thing. So I
went up and stocked up, huh?
And my nieces said to me, Auntie, you really need to get a bit more modern. You know, you need to do Instagram. And I said, but, you know, I have a Facebook page. They're like, auntie, it's people who are, you know, 60 and above who do Facebook.
Yeah,
I really find a lot of social media, it's not my thing, really. I'm enjoying having pictures taken for it, but it's really not my thing. So the agreement was that I would make sure pictures are taken. I would send the pictures to them, and then they would make the selection and put them up. And it works out really well.
Never in my life have I read so much about or considered or thought about hair as when I read your novel. I mean, it's amazing because the first scene in the book is you're going to, or the character, if Emily is getting her hair braided. First of all, it takes hours. I mean, I had no idea. I mean, it's like 4 hours to get your hair. I mean,
longer.
That's crazy. I mean, that's a commitment, you know. But you know, you talk about this. I was put in mind of a Joni Mitchell song, which I love, called The Boho Zone, where she's talking about the bohemian life versus the sort of stylish Parisian, you know, beautiful dresses and silk stockings. Mm. And she says at the end of the tune, she says, nothing is capsulized in me on either side of town. The streets were never really mine, not mine, these glamour gowns. I mean, that tension between the rough life of the artiste and the life of the sophisticate. I mean, do you experience that personally? Mm. And how does that inform our notion of what being a woman is, what being a feminist is?
Do I experience that? No, not really, because the sort of the whole bohemian aesthetic has never been mine. And I grew up, in many ways, it's about the way that I grew up. I grew up the child of, middle-class Nigerians who raised me in a particular way. You were supposed to care about your appearance every Sunday at church. Your socks were supposed to be perfectly white. You know, the lacy ruffles were supposed to be just so. My mother put the ribbons that matched in my hair. That I grew up in that way. And there's a part of me that's still very much that middle-class Igbo child who... So actually, when I came to the U.S., I remember realizing that in some ways to be seen as a serious writer meant that you had to... You couldn't appear to care too much about your appearance. You had to sort of have a certain... look that meant you were too busy thinking about writing and books to brush your hair, you know. And I remember thinking, but I've always thought about writing and books, but I've also always brushed my hair.
But the thing is, you're allowed to and, be both,
but,
right?
But the thing is, but you know, you would be surprised at how that is my position. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do these things publicly, which is to say that feminism and femininity are not mutually exclusive, and to think about the younger women who I know care about these things and also care about ideas and books and writing, but feel that they shouldn't. And so my choosing to sort of in some ways come out publicly and stop hiding my high heels was simply to say, this is who I am. It doesn't make me any less of anything. And I don't feel the need to justify it. I don't feel the need also to intellectualize it. I don't feel the need to say that my love of dresses is really a manifestation of something. It just is a love of dresses.
You talk about feminism in the plural, feminisms. Mm. There are social critics, public intellectuals, and you among them have talked about the feminism of Beyonce or Rihanna as being sort of not necessarily related to the feminism of others, but it is a very mixed bag. Is there such thing as a universal feminism, the one tent under which every single person fits?
Yes, I think that there is such a thing. The universal idea is the premise, which is that men and women are fundamentally completely equal. That it's not something, you know, we're not negotiating that. But then how we go about manifesting it, because I think it's important to have a multiplicity and to have diversity within that world of feminism. Also because there are other things, you know, I think race affects gender, class affects gender, religion affects region, the region of the world in which you live. There are things that are not the same for people, but the premise is the same. So this is why I often say to people that for me, feminism is always contextual. That there's certain things in certain parts of the world that somebody would say, oh, that doesn't really seem feminist to me. But in another part of the world, actually is. And so it's not to say that everything goes, right? It's to say that if we start off with the fundamental premise, which has to be the same for everyone, then I think that the variations in the practice of that premise.
And one of the suggestions you make to your young friend Ijewele is to be careful not to turn oppressed people into saints.
Mm.
I mean, we have to look at this clear-eyed.
Mm.
You know, you say saintliness is not a prerequisite for dignity.
Mm.
You don't need saintliness to be deserving of dignity.
Mm.
Do you think there's an impulse? I think about like what happened with the Women's March the day after the inauguration in January, where there was clearly a tension between white feminists and feminists of color.
Mm.
People who were in the pro-life movement were women and wanted to be part of it, and they were disallowed. And there were all across the political spectrum some difficult conversations that were not resolved.
Mm.
And in terms of the left, the political left, I mean, is there an impulse to elevate just sort of everybody in an uncritical way?
Yes.
Do you worry about that?
Yes, very much. I think it's one of the, and not to unduly go back to the trans debate, but I think it's also part of it. There's that need to say that we're all the same. We're all the same. And to say that, I think, is to silence. It's a silencing tool. And I think it's also, I think it's dishonest, and I don't think it's very helpful. And I think it's also a way of avoiding discomfort, because, you know, if you say that we're all the same, then you don't have to talk about things that are potentially uncomfortable. With the Women's March, the one place I might take a bit of exception to is women who insist on the pro-life agenda for everybody. You know, I think that...
Well, it's the we're all the same argument.
Right, yeah. Right. I have a problem with that. I think that it's a perfectly... I think it's a perfectly valid position to be personally opposed to abortion. And I completely respect that. I grew up in a Catholic household. But I also think it's just deeply wrong to impose it on everyone, you know, because you don't know what people's stories are.
And of course, so much of the argument about feminism or race or gender is about power.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about who's allowed to either be at the table and then if at the table to speak.
Yes.
Who gets to be heard.
Yes.
And it's difficult. I mean, you write, if a woman has power, why do we need to disguise that she has power? That's a danger, too.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. I mean, this really, all of this is about power in the end. That's what it's about. It's whose voice is heard, whose voice is given certain kind of, whose voice is the voice. And when we talk about power and women, I find it fascinating. And I think particularly in this country, I mean, I was telling a friend that the more I think about it, that it seems to me that women and power in this country is something that makes people even more uncomfortable than it does in Nigeria. Women in Nigeria, the idea of a woman being in a powerful position very quickly becomes ordinary once she has attained that position. But I find that in this country, it's still very, there are always ways to disguise it, that even the women have to perform in ways that diminish their own power, if that makes sense, because they have to make people feel comfortable with it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This whole comfort. You also talk about this curse of being likable.
Yes.
And this obsession with being likable. We get to talk more about this at the City Lit Festival a week from Saturday, and I look forward to it. It's been great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, she's the headline author at the Baltimore City Lit Festival a week from Saturday, the 29th. She and I will hold a public conversation on that day at 12:30 at the Angelos Law Center at the University of Baltimore. And again, that event is sold out, but the City Lit Project is offering tickets to an overflow room and to the live video feed. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie will sign books after that event. There's lots more going on at the City Lit Festival as well. For example, there's a workshop about writing diverse narratives with the MacArthur Award-winning Ethiopian-American writer Dinah Mengestu. There's lots of stuff to interest writers and readers, so to get a complete list, come to wipr.org/midday and we'll share the link. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation about missing and exploited children and teens. Human trafficking expert Kimberly Melman Orozco and Natalie Wilson of the Black and Missing Foundation join me to talk about the factors that drive missing persons cases. That conversation is happening tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.